I'll tell you about this work. It's done by my student, Shubhankar Katwa, and with Professor Deepthi Mansain at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. So I come from the Institute of Mathematical Sciences in Chennai, in the south of India, where Professor Bhaskaran is from. And this is some recent work that we've done. So I'll tell you about this. Good. So the entire talk will be premised on one principle that I'll try to present you. I'll try to convince you about this. So I'll try to convince you that a cluster of quantum spins at low energies maps to a single particle moving on the corresponding classical ground state space. Okay, I'll show you many examples. I'll try to build upon this carefully. So the key thing to note here is, if you have a problem of quantum spins, spins that interact with each other, in general that's an interacting problem that's hard to solve. But the claim is, if you look at it in the limit of low energies, it becomes a single particle problem. It's in principle solvable. And the single particle here moves on a space, and that space is the space of all ground states. Okay, so the entire talk builds on this, and we'll see it has very interesting consequences as you look at bigger and bigger systems. Good. So just to give you some motivation in case, so the way we can think of this is from the path integral language. So don't worry about the details here. I'll actually show it to you later. So just to give you a brief summary of this slide. So there is a well-defined path integral formalism for spins. And if you write that path integral formalism, you know, you have a path integral over classical configurations of spins, where you assume spins to be classical vectors in three dimensions that are moving around. And you can write a path in that space where every spin is oriented in some direction. Then you can make some reasonable assumption about low energies. In that case, you see that the path integral for the spin problem becomes the same as the path integral for a single particle problem, the way we write path integral quantum mechanics for a single problem. So there's an equivalence at the level of the path integrals. So at low energies, the partition function is dominated by paths within the classical ground state space. So the single particle we have in mind moves only on the classical ground state space. So I will show you this in some more detail. So for now, let's just, this is the premise on which this is built. Good. Okay. Good. So in the talk, I will give you four examples. And they're chosen just for simplicity, they're in order of increasing complexity. So you'll see that it becomes more and more complex and more interesting things emerge. So the most interesting results emerge for the last case. But we'll come to that at the end. So you'll have to stay till the end to see what's so interesting about that. Good. So we'll discuss four clusters. So this is just a dimer, two spins. And here there are three spins at the corners of an equilateral triangle. And here there are four spins at the corners of a tetrahedron. This is just a distorted tetrahedron. Okay. I'll tell you why that's interesting, why we have to do this. In all cases, we'll assume that the spins are coupled by x-y interactions. So for instance, here you have the x component of this talks to the x component of this, the y component of this talks to the y component of this. So that's the simplest Hamiltonian that you can write. And we'll see that even within this simple family of clusters, very interesting physics emerges. So you might think it's only four spins. It should be trivial, but it's not. There's very new physics we can learn from this. Good. So in particular, let's just first focus on three of those clusters because they have some nice geometric properties. So just a dimer, a regular triangle, an equilateral triangle, and a regular tetrahedron. So these three objects are very common in frustrated magnetism. They're the building blocks of all, pretty much every interesting frustrated magnet that we have. So they're fundamental motifs in frustrated magnetism, and they have a nice geometric property. You know, this perimeter has this sign saying, those uninterested in geometry, please do not enter, or something to that effect. So I'm hoping this will be of interest to all of you. So you see here, you have two spins. There's only one distance between them. Here you have three spins, and every pair is separated by the same distance. And here you have four vertices, and every pair is separated by the same distance. In that sense, they're simplex geometries. In 3D space, you can only have these three. You cannot build bigger simplex structures. Okay. So if you consider an XY Hamiltonian on this, and let's say you think of it in the classical limit, so you imagine the spins are classical objects, then the Hamiltonian is actually very simple. Okay. Without too much work, with a few lines, you can rewrite the Hamiltonian as this. I'll just tell you what this amounts to. So the Hamiltonian is this. So you write one term, which is the sum of all the spins. So for example, if you have four spins, you add all the four spins, and you take the xy component. That's the parallel sign there. You take the xy component of the total spin, and you square it. And then there's another term with a minus sign. Here what you do is, you take the xy component of each spin separately and you square it and you add it. So the Hamiltonian takes this form. Okay. Don't worry too much about this. The upshot is this. This is what you should see. So for all three of these, you have this property. If I want to minimize the Hamiltonian, I have to minimize this, and I have to maximize this, because this has a minus sign. I'm assuming J is positive, right? So I have to minimize this, and I have to maximize this. If I have to do that, all spins must lie in the xy plane, and they must add to zero. So that's a very nice, simple geometric condition. Here you have two spins. They must lie in the xy plane. They must add to zero. You have three. They must lie in the plane, and they must add to zero. Here you have four that must lie in the xy plane, and they must add to zero.
So just to clarify, all the sides share the same xy plane? So it's a global?
Yes, it's global xy plane. Yes, there's only one xy for all of them. Good, okay. So let's begin with the simplest problem, the dimer. Only two spins. And let's first think about what is the classical ground state space for this. So if I have two spins coupled by this, how can I make the Hamiltonian is of course xy. In the classical limit, a ground state looks like this. If I fix the first spin in the xy plane this way, the second spin has to be opposite. That's the way you minimize energy, right? So you see that they're both in the plane and they add to zero. But you could have put the first spin wherever you like. You could have changed this angle phi, and the second spin would have just followed. Okay. So that tells you that the space of all ground states is equivalent to the number of choices you have of placing the first spin. You could have placed it anywhere in the circle. So the set of all ground states is equivalent to a circle in this problem. So the ground state space is S1, which is just a circle. So now, according to this principle that I showed you, the low energy states should map to a particle on a ring. And let me show you that that's actually true. So this is just the two-spin problem with the XY Hamiltonian and diagonalized. So you have to diagonalize this on a computer. You cannot diagonalize it analytically. For a Heisenberg spin, you could do it analytically. Okay. So here's the spectrum. Okay. So the dots here are for different S values. You know, quantum spins have an S quantum number, the total spin quantum number. And here we show different S values. And for each spin, this is just the state index, and that's the energy. And in the energy, I've just shifted the origin, and I've scaled it. It's like changing the units. Okay, that's all I've done. Then you see that for all the spins, the spectra fall on top of each other. Okay, not just that, they have a very nice form. You see that there's a single ground state. It might not be very clear for you, but you see there's all dots sit there. And the first excited state is doubly degenerate. Next excited state is doubly degenerate, and so on. Okay. Not just that, you look at the energies, the ground state energy is zero. It's, you know, you choose the scaling, and you choose the shifts as zero. The first excited state is 1, second is 4, 9, 16, 25, 36, and so on. Okay. So you notice these are just squares of numbers. So just the XY problem, if you diagonalize it, if you only look at the low energy spectrum, you don't look at the high energy states, they have this nice structure. The energies are simply LZ squared, where LZ is something like 0, plus minus 1, plus minus 2, plus minus 3. This is precisely the spectrum of a particle on a circle. A particle on a circle has angular momentum as a good quantum number. The energy is just LZ squared. Ground state is 0 angular momentum. First excited state is plus or minus 1. Second is plus or minus 2, and so on. Okay. So I claim to have demonstrated this to you for the dimer. Okay. So you see that the low energy spectrum really does look like that of a particle moving on a circle, a particle moving in the classical ground state space. Okay, so let's look at the next more complicated case. Before doing that, let me try to explain to you why this is true, or how you can see this. So you can see this from the language of path integrals, but let me first tell you how we do that. So just look, we can just look at this. So this is the first spin, and that's the second spin. And here I've characterized a ground state. So I've said the first spin is given by some n hat, some unit vector. Second spin is minus n hat. So together, that's a ground state. They're in plane, they're opposite, that's a ground state. So now I want to add small fluctuations about the ground state. So at low energies, you would imagine that you're always close to a ground state with only small fluctuations. So I'm going to add small fluctuations to these. And if you just count the degrees of freedom, there are, you know, 6 free parameters in total. So I've already used up, one parameter to define this n hat. So I'm free to fix 5 more parameters, and I fix them in the following way. Okay. So, actually should be, okay, well, let's not worry too much about it. There's some normalization condition. So let me just tell you what I'm adding. So the first spin is here, second spin is in the ground state. Now I add a small fluctuation. The first fluctuation I add is of this form. So I add here, I just take it out of the plane, plus z, or, you know, minus z to this, and plus z to this, so a staggered deviation to this. Another fluctuation I add is total L. So I'll add one vector both to this as well as to that, and that can be in any direction. I'll deform both spins in some way, in some parallel way. If I do this, I exhaust all possibilities, at least locally. Small fluctuations, I can only do this. And there is a constraint to preserve normalization, and that's this L vector that you add has to be normal to N, otherwise the spin length would change. So N dot L is zero. So if you do this, you would parameterize the spins in the following way. So you'd say that each spin, the overall length is S, and there's an N hat, the second spin is minus N hat. And then there is a small fluctuation. The fluctuation has these two parts, one is L, one is M. And then for normalization, you'll have to write it like this. So you'll have to make sure it's normalized. Okay. So if you do that, now you have to make the assumption that the fluctuations are small. So the way we do it, you know, for bookkeeping purposes, is we introduce this S parameter, the length of the spin, and we assume that's very large, much greater than one. And the fluctuations are of order one, so they're actually very small. So this is the content of the low energy approximation. The fluctuations are always small about a ground state. Now, if we just do this, and then just plug this in into the action, into the path integral, we see that the action takes a very nice form. I'm skipping some details, but you can check this out. So the action has, you see that all the fluctuations we had, they turn out to be costly fluctuations. They have energies that are positive definite. So Lx squared, energy increases, Ly squared, Lz squared, M squared. And because they're quadratic, you can integrate them out. And the quadratic, we've assumed them to be quadratic. We've assumed them to be small, so we can do this. You can integrate it out. And once you integrate this out, the action reduces to this, phi dot squared, where phi is just this angle. And this is precisely the path integral action for a particle on a circle. Okay? So what I claim to have done is, I claim to have written the path integral, the spin path integral, a genuine spin path integral for the two-spin problem. And I claim to have made a low energy approximation, and the path integral reduces to that of a particle on a circle. So this is why the spectrum at low energies looks like that of a particle on a circle. This is one way to understand this. Okay? So this proof, I'll only show this explicitly for the XY case, but a similar proof can be worked out for all the cases that I show, except for the last one. So in general, this is always true. You can take an arbitrary system. You can assume that there's a ground state parameterized by, you know, P set of parameters, and there are Q parameters that take you out of the ground state space. You can write a small energy, low energy partition function. You can prove that the partition function for the spins maps to a particle moving on the ground state space.
So you have to put a spin as large as 8 in order to see this numerically?
To see a large number. So even for spin 1, you already see a few states. You see, I forget the exact number, you see something like this.
This contains data more than...
Here, I've only shown these four because it gives you enough, there is enough data points to see this. So the S controls where the other states come in. So that's why we need to use this. Okay, so good. Now let's move to the next more complicated case, and it's also more interesting case. So now we have spins at the corners of a triangle. So the three spins here, okay. And now let's ask, what is the ground state space of this? Now I should have, as I explained to you, I should have three vectors that lie in the plane and they should add to zero. Okay? So the way they can do that is you can make a triangle. You start from 1, 2, 3, the sum is zero. You come back to the same point. But there is a chirality here. You could do something like 1, 2, 3, or you can rotate this in any direction you like. Just do an overall rotation. Have so one point somewhere there, 2, 3. That would also work. But you can also make another configuration like this. You can say 1, and now here 2 went to the right. Here you could go to the left. 1, 2, 3. And then you can do any rotations of this. So you'll see that these two represent two different chiralities. By rotating this, you'll never get this. By just rotating within the xy plane, you'll never go from here to here. So the set of all ground states is actually two circles. I can take this and I can rotate it by any angle. I can take this state and I can rotate it by any angle. So the set of ground states is actually something like this. I can have 1, 2, 3 going clockwise, or 1, 3, 2 going clockwise. And the angle between them is 120 degrees because they form an equilateral triangle. And I can put the first spin anywhere. So this is actually, the set of all such states is S1. This is one circle. The set of all such states is another circle. So the ground state space is actually two distinct circles. Okay, so there is a Z2 variable which tells you which circle you're on. Okay. So by the same argument, we'll say that at low energies, if you look at this cluster, the low energy physics of this maps to that of a particle that lives on two rings, two separate circles. So let me show you that that's true. So here it is. Here is the data for just three spins, various S values, and the spectrum is found numerically, and scaled and shifted appropriately. So you see that spectra fall on top of each other. Not sure if you can see this. The ground state is doubly degenerate. There are two states there. First excited state is fourfold degenerate, fourfold degenerate, fourfold, 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 and so on. The energies are again 0, 1, 4, 9, 16. They're the squares. So again, it's a particle on a ring, except there are now two copies. There are two ground states, four excited states, and so on. So here again, very nicely, the low energy spectrum maps to that of a particle moving on the ground state space. Okay?
So unlike the previous case, you don't have half integers here.
So that is this slide. So good. Thank you for this question. But something different happens when you go to half integers. Okay? So here I showed 7, 8, 9. Here's 7.5, 8.5, 9.5. So the spectrum actually changes, which is somewhat hard to see. But if you look carefully, you'll see that the ground state here is only twofold degenerate. Here it's fourfold degenerate. So ground state is fourfold, 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 and so on. The energies also change. It becomes 1, 9, 25. There's still squares, but squares of odd numbers. So this actually tells us something very important. This is the spectrum of a particle moving on two circles, but each circle has a pi flux threaded through it. Okay. In other words, you might just imagine there's a particle on a circle, but it has anti-periodic boundary conditions, not periodic boundary conditions. Okay. Then you would get precisely this spectrum. Okay. So we can work this out. If we just work the particle on the two rings problem with the pi flux, the spectrum is Lz minus half squared. So you see that 0 and 1 give you the same energy, you know, for a single circle. Now there are two circles, so you have four ground states. Then minus 1, 2 give you the first excited state, and so on. Okay. So why did this happen? So we have a particle moving in the ground state space, but now this particle sees some kind of an Ahrenau-Bohm flux. It moves around and it sees a magnetic field. So that is also possible. So it's consistent with our picture. So if we go back to the spin language, if you see the spin path integral is written like this. It's an integral over all classical configurations in time, paths in classical configuration space. The action has two terms. There's an energy term, and then there's a Berry phase term. Of course, the energy term tells you that at low energies, only the ground state space is picked out. Okay. But the Berry phase term still exists, and that's a complex phase. And the Berry phase in the spin language has a very nice geometric interpretation. So imagine we have closed paths in spin space. So imagine the first spin goes around a closed path, comes back, and completes the path. Okay. So it sweeps out an area from the North Pole. The Berry phase is simply this area times S. So that's the geometric meaning of Berry phase. So this, you'll find it in textbooks, Auerbach, for instance. Okay. So here what happens? So when you have half integer spins, so our ground state looks something like this. So this is one particular ground state. You have 1, 2, 3, first spin, second spin, third spin. Okay. How can we have a closed path within the ground state space? We can imagine that I'll rotate this. So I'll rotate the whole configuration. So the first spin goes all the way around and comes back. The second spin also goes around and third spin comes back. So you come back to the original configuration after one rotation. That's a closed path. So when you do the closed path, you see that the first spin is actually going around the equator. This pole. The second spin also goes around the equator. Third spin also goes around the equator. So each spin covers the area of one hemisphere, which is 2 pi, which is the area of the whole sphere. The surface area is 4 pi r squared. R is 1. So 4 pi, area of one hemisphere is 2 pi. So now you have three spins. So each spin gives you 2 pi, and there's an s, so it's 2 pi s. Because you have three, the total Berry phase is 6 pi s. So now if you see if s is a half integer, this becomes odd multiple of pi. So for instance, if s is half, this is 3 pi, which is the same as pi. Because this. Okay. So you get a pi flux here in the Berry phase term. So now when we say we take this cluster and we map it to a particle moving on the classical ground state space, we have to be careful. We have to introduce Ahrenau-Bohm fluxes as well. So the particle can see Ahrenau-Bohm fluxes, which come from the Berry phase. So we have to qualify the statement. The low energy physics maps to a particle on the ground state space. The particle might see an Ahrenau-Bohm phase, depending on the on the geometry of the problem. Good, so these are the two simple cases. Now let's move to something a little bit more complicated. Please feel free to stop me if anything. So let's move to slightly bigger cluster. Okay. So now I'll say I have four spins. The four spins are placed like this. So it's a tetrahedron. But the tetrahedron is distorted. So you see this bond is shorter than this bond. So this bond is shorter, that bond is shorter, every other bond is longer. So it's as if you take a regular tetrahedron and just pull it apart, you distort it. We squeeze two ends. Okay. Now, if you write the tetrahedron like this, so you can imagine that you start from a symmetric tetrahedron and you squeeze it. And you can ask, so first you can ask, what is the Hamiltonian for this? So the Hamiltonian is, again, these are all xy dot products. We're always working with xy models here for illustration purposes. So these are all xy dot products. But we assume that this bond is strong. This bond is strong, stronger than these two. So you have extra strong bonds, two bonds become stronger. Now you can ask, what's the classical ground state space? As before, all four spins must lie in the plane, they must add to zero. But because this bond is strong and this one is strong, so let's say this is spin one, that's spin two. Spin one and two are always forced to be opposite to each other. Okay. This can be fairly easily shown. I can show it to you afterwards if you like. Okay. So the classical ground state space for this looks something like this. Spin one and spin two must be opposite to each other. Spin three and spin four must be opposite to each other. But the relative orientation doesn't matter. I can put spin one wherever I like, spin two will follow, spin three wherever I like, and spin four will follow. So it's as if you have two rods that are just moving. So now let's again ask, what is the ground state space? So how many parameters do I have to give to you to specify a ground state? So I have to give you two angles. So I have to give you the position of the first spin, that fixes the second spin. I have to give you the position of the third spin, that fixes the fourth spin. So I have to give you two angles, and the angles are continuous up to 2 pi. 0 to 2 pi, and 2 pi is the same as 0. So this space actually looks like a torus. Okay. So imagine I have one angle that goes around here. So 0 to 2 pi, I come back to the same point. And there's another angle here, so 0 to 2 pi, I come back to the same point. So the ground state space for this problem is a torus. Okay. So earlier we had particles and rings, and now we have a two-dimensional space, which is a torus. Okay. So this is a two-dimensional space, and you can check that there's no periphase here. There's no periphase, it's not an issue. So what we expect is the low energy physics should map to a single particle moving on a torus. This is again true. So here is a spectrum, just this kind of a configuration with some, we've assumed that this bond is stronger. This bond is twice this, with that assumption. We find the spectrum for two different S values. As before, I've just scaled it, shifted it. You see there are many states. And if you look at the energy eigenvalues, there are 0, 1, 2, 4, 5, 8, 9, 10, 13, 16, 17, 18, 20, 25. These might look somewhat strange, but if you work it out, this is exactly the spectrum of a particle on a torus. Okay, you have two momenta, so it's like n squared plus m squared, two integers that square and add. Okay, you'll get precisely this. So not only does the spectrum match, each level has some degeneracy, and the degeneracy matches very well. Okay. So for the problem on a torus, the ground state is non-degenerate. First excited state is fourfold degenerate, which you can easily check. The spin problem also gives you fourfold degeneracy. So the parentheses is actually the degeneracy of each state. So the degeneracy is also reproduced. So you get a very large number of states that look like a particle moving on a torus. So the claim here is you take this spin problem, the XY model on this cluster, at low energies, it looks like a particle moving on a torus. And if you only looked at the spectrum, you cannot tell the difference. I mean, if you only look at the low energy spectrum. Good? Yes, sure.
What are the small variations on the purple dots?
The purple dots here?
Yeah.
Yes. So there is some, it's not, the matching is not perfect, but as S increases, it becomes better and better. So it's hard to see in this plot, but you can actually look at some other plots you see. So as you increase S, it becomes more and more flat. Right now there are small deviations. Good, okay. I hope to have convinced you of this story so far. Yes, please.
Periphase does not play a part here.
It does not play a part here. So you can check that it does not play a part. So any close path you take has a periphase of 2 pi or a multiple of 2 pi, which is the same as 0. Good, so if all's well, we'll move to the most complicated case, which also has very, very interesting physics. Physics is very surprising here. So let me try to describe this to you. So this is a regular tetrahedron. We have four spins. And all the couplings are the same because all the lengths are the same. You can imagine that all the XY couplings are the same. So now what is the ground state? So as before, this is a simplex figure. So we must have all four spins lying in plane and they must add to zero. How can you do that? It essentially amounts to this. So I have four vectors. If I lay them head to tail, they should come back to the same point. That's vector addition, right, in a plane. Right? So imagine I have four sticks, I could lay them out, say needles, knitting needles or something of that sort, and I have to come back to the starting point. How can I do that? You can easily see that I have to necessarily form a rhombus. There's no other way. Whatever I do, I have to form a rhombus. Only then I'll come back to the same point. But if you form a rhombus, you can see that this spin and that spin are opposite. This vector and that vector are opposite to each other. That vector and this vector are opposite to each other. So you necessarily pick out pairs. You take one pair and you make them opposite. You take another pair and you make them opposite. And the relative orientation doesn't matter. You can make the rhombus flat. You can squeeze it like this. You can also rotate the rhombus. That's okay. But apart from that, you have to have two that are opposite to each other. But if you look at this, this is actually more complicated, much more complicated than before, because there are many ways to do this. You must form two pairs from the four spins. You can do it in three distinct ways. Okay. So I can assume that one and two are opposite to each other, three and four are opposite to each other. Okay. That's one possibility. Or I can say one and three are opposite to each other, two and four are opposite to each other. That's actually the case shown here. One and three are opposite, two and four are opposite. Or I could have one and four opposite and two and three opposite. They're all equally valid. So you have three discrete possibilities apart from any continuous symmetries that you have. Okay. So now let's imagine one of these. So let's say I take this case. So one and three are opposite, two and four are opposite. Now how many continuous parameters do I have? You can see that I can place the first spin wherever I like. So three would just follow this. If one goes here, three would just be opposite to that. Then I can fix, so that's one angle. I fix theta one. I can fix one more angle, the position of 2, and I can fix it with reference to 1, the theta 2, 1, the deviation from 1 to 2. And once I fix 2, 4 is automatically fixed. So within this set of configurations, I have two angles that I can fix, and they're angle variables, so they're continuous at 2 pi. So the set of all such states is one torus, as we described before. But we see we have three distinct possibilities. So this corresponds to one torus, this corresponds to one torus, this corresponds to one torus. Okay. But it's actually more interesting than that. So let me show this to you. So this is precisely what I've described to you. There are three cases. Each case corresponds to a torus. So the first angle can be anywhere between 0 to 2 pi. That's theta 1. The second angle can also be between 0 and 2 pi. And then there's periodic boundary conditions. Here, the top line and the bottom line are the same. Left line and the right line are the same. So the square with periodic boundary conditions is a torus. So we have a torus. Good. So we have three different tori, one for this, one for this, one for this. But we see that there are actually common points here. Okay? So to show this, let me focus on one of this. Let's first look at this case, where 1 and 3 are opposite, 2 and 4 are opposite. And let me consider the case where theta 2, 1 is 0. Okay? So here this theta 2, 1 is a y-axis, so I'm assuming that theta 2, 1 is 0. So if theta 2, 1 is 0, then 2 and 1 are on top of each other. Then 3 and 4 will be on top of each other. You'll get a configuration of this form. 1 and 2 are on top of each other, 3 and 4 are on top of each other. But this could be in any orientation. I can have any theta 1. I can have 1 lying in any direction. You'll have states of this form. Okay? So now let's consider this case where 1 and 4 are opposite, 2 and 3 are always opposite. Once again, let me fix theta 2, 1 is 0. Then that will tell me 2 and 1 are on top of each other, 3 and 4 are again opposite to each other. So you get this state again. So this state is the same as this state that you got. So you can easily see that this entire line of this torus is the same as this line of this torus. So this torus and this torus share a common line. Okay? And you can work out the other combinations. You see that these two tori share one common line. These two tori share one common line. That's the black line. Okay? So you have three tori, but the tori touch at lines. They're not distinct tori. Okay? So there's a way to imagine this. The space looks like this. So what I've drawn here is a cross section. So imagine I have a giant donut. So I've just cut it in half and I'm showing you the cross section. So you can look at the blue figure for now. So that's one face of the donut. Then it goes into the screen, comes back out, and you have the other face. and actually it goes out and completes this. Okay, so it's a cross-section of a torus. But inside this torus, you have two other tori that are sitting. Okay? So let's look at the yellow torus. This is another torus that's sitting inside this torus. And that again goes out, comes in. The blue torus and the yellow torus share a common line. They touch along this line, and this line actually goes in all the way and comes out there, and would actually come back out and complete the circle. Okay? So they actually touch along a circle. So similarly, these two tori, the purple torus and the yellow torus, they share one line, the green dots. You go in here and come out. And then this torus and the blue torus, they share one common line that comes out here. So you can imagine this is three tori, but the tori are actually touching each other. They're sitting top of each other. Okay. So this is the ground state space for this problem. The ground state space is very different from what we had before. So just to remind you, we took four spins on a tetrahedron. You're trying to find the classical ground state space. And I hope to have convinced you that ground state space looks like this. It's three tori that touch. So just to show you why this is special, this is a non-manifold space. By that, what I mean is this. So suppose you take a generic point, some point there. That point represents a classical ground state, one particular classical ground state. And you see that I have 2 degrees of freedom. I can move this way or that way. There are 2 independent degrees of freedom, which means I can distort the ground state in 2 ways while preserving the energy. Okay, so ground state space is 2-dimensional there. However, if you're sitting at this common point, now there are 2 surfaces touching at one line, dimensionality is not well-defined in that kind of space. You don't have well-defined dimensions. So this point is not 2-dimensional, strictly speaking. So this space is not 2-dimensional everywhere. That's the definition of a manifold. A manifold is a space that always locally looks like it has the same dimensions, and that's not the case here. Okay, so this space is a non-manifold space. So the classical ground state space of this is non-manifold. So as before, our claim is that the low energy physics of this spin cluster maps to a particle moving on this space. Okay? Now this is a very tricky, so I'll try to convince you that this is true, but just to drive this point home, this is a difficult problem to study. Imagine a particle moving on this space. How can you study its dynamics? If you want to write a kinetic energy operator, you'd first have to write something like a momentum. But on this space, you can't even define gradients because here dimensionality is not well defined. So how do you study the motion of a particle on this space? That by itself is a tricky problem. Okay. So we found a way to do that. So the way to do that, or at least the way we think it's a very good way to do it, is to actually do it numerically. So we discretize this space. We make a mesh. We make a tight binding mesh. And we say this blue torus is this. It has these points. And if the particle is sitting here, it can move on to its nearest neighbors. The mesh looks a little tilted. Don't worry too much about that. There are some reasons why it has to be tilted. So we make one mesh for this, and one mesh for that, one mesh for this. But we make sure that the meshes share the common lines. So for instance, if you're at this red line, if you're at a dot sitting there at one site, you are free to move here on this plane, but the same site repeats here. You can also move from that point onto this. So this is a fairly easy problem to write on a computer. So you write a Hamiltonian for this tight binding problem, and we'll solve it. Okay. And when we do that, it matches very well. Okay. So here is the results. So this is, of course, there are 2 fitting parameters. In the tight binding model, we have to fix the size of the mesh, how dense the mesh is. We have to fix the hopping parameter for the tight binding problem. We treat those 2 as fitting parameters. But if we use those 2 parameters to fit it, the spectrum agrees very well. So here, for instance, is spin 4. So the white dots are the spin. They're obtained by diagonalizing the spin problem, genuine writing the Hamiltonian, diagonalizing on a computer. There's no doubts about that. So the blue dots are obtained from a tight binding problem with the correct fitting parameters, or the best parameters we could find. So you see that you get the degeneracy pattern very well. There's 1 ground state, 2 excited states, 6 states. So most of the states agree. They're on top of each other. There are still some small deviations. But as you make S bigger, so here S is 12, for instance, you see that they're virtually on top of each other. So the tight binding model works very well. It gives you even things like the splitting. You have 4 and 2 above. So 2 and 4 above, it gives you every level. It gives you a large number of levels, and they all agree very well. Okay, so the claim is the low energy physics of this maps to a particle moving on this space, and that can be studied using a tight binding model. Okay. There's still time. So it just becomes a little bit more complicated, but Good. I haven't told you the interesting physics yet. Please keep that in mind, that we're coming to that. So before that, there is a Berry phase term here, which appears in some strange parts. So this is the classical ground state space, as I've told you. Now I can ask, if I have closed paths in this classical ground state space, do I accrue a non-zero Berry phase or a non-trivial Berry phase? The answer is yes. There are paths which give you a non-trivial Berry phase, but there are a very specific number of paths, not very many paths. So the paths have to look like this. First of all, you have to have half integer spins. For integer spins, all paths are trivial. There is no Berry phase. Okay. You must have half integer S, and you must have a path of this form. Suppose you start from this torus, in point P, you go up to point Q, but this red line is common to this, so you come to this Q, and here you go vertically to R, to the green line, but the green line is also here, so this R is here. Now you go back up on this torus, now you come back to the point P. This point P is here. This is a closed loop. Another way to imagine imagine this is a cross section. So suppose you start from this point, you move along the torus, you go here, and then you come back along the other two tori. Okay, you form a loop like that. So you have to traverse all three tori. That path alone gives you pi berry phase in the spin path interval. So how do we reconcile this with the particle picture? Okay. So we have the particle moving on this space. So now what we see is the particle sees a Berry phase if it moves like this. So we model this, we can take this into account, as a pi flux tube that's inserted in the space. Okay. So imagine there's a solenoid going in here, coming out there, and then actually just completes itself. There's another solenoid here that goes in, comes out, and then completes itself. So these are two pi flux tubes, two solenoids. So when the particle hops, it sees, it feels an Aharonov-Bohm flux because of this. So we can take this into account easily in the tight binding model. We have to put in piles fluxes, which is the standard way to take into account these. But we can do that. And after we do that, once again, it agrees very well.
You have to fit the flux, so that's prescribed?
That's pi. There's no flux. So the pi comes from the XY model.
So the link field, the line integral of the gauge field is prescribed?
Yes, the line integral over the path is specified. We have some degrees of freedom. How we distribute it is, doesn't matter. Right. Okay. So here, for instance, is a spectrum for spin 2.5 and spin 9.5. So if you have half integer spin and you don't put the Berry flux, you will not get the correct answer. Okay. So you have to put this Berry flux. But once you do that, the tight binding model sits on top of the spin spectrum. So the low energy states of this cluster with spin half look like a particle moving on this space, which sees this pi flux tubes. So you see that 9.5 again, it works very well.
Having the flux tubes separately.
Yes.
How does it look at any part? It seems to enclose both flux tubes.
Yes. So if you go on a closed path that goes like this, there is no flux. If you get pi from this is 2 pi is 0.
Yes. When does it make it? Oh, I see.
So you have to do this.
Choose a cuspy path.
So you have to go on each, so half of this torus, half of this torus, and half of it. Only then you get this. Okay, so now let me come to the long promised interesting part. Okay. So far I hope to have convinced you that the low energy spectrum for any cluster maps to a particle moving on the classical ground state space, provided you take into account the Berry phase effects. And in particular for the tetrahedron, it maps to a non-manifold space, but we can study particle dynamics on that using tight binding, and that still agrees. I hope to have convinced you of this so far. Please ask me if not. Okay. So let me tell you that something very interesting actually pops out of this result. Okay. So let me show you this. So this is just the same mesh as I showed you before, same quadrumer, the tetrahedron, four-spin problem. And now we have mapped it to a tight binding problem of a particle moving on some mesh. So in the tight binding problem, it's very easy to see the ground state or any wave function. The tight binding model will give you some wave function. You can easily plot it on the mesh. And you can see where is the probability, how the probability is distributed. So this, you know, you have these three tori, the three meshes, and the meshes have common lines. And now we take the ground state we get from this problem for some parameters, doesn't matter which one. I'll tell you what it is. We take the ground state and we plot the amplitude of finding the particle at a given position. And it looks like this. So you, this is already very surprising, if you just look at it in the following way. So you see, this is a ground state. There's a unique ground state, a single ground state. In the tight bending problem as well, there's a unique ground state. And the probabilities look like this. So you see that the probability is very large here, but it is small in the middle. You can actually, and it's the same here. And these are actually those common lines. So you see the red line is here, that's common. With the red line, it's large. The black line is common to these two tori, there the probability is large. The green line is common here, there the probability is large. You can also see that as you move away from these common lines, the wave function decays exponentially. The probability, you can see that here it's large, and as you move away, it decays exponentially. So it looks like in the ground state, the particle is moving on this space, but it likes to sit near the common lines. That's actually very unusual. So if you take a particle on a circle, for instance, you look at the ground state, the particle can be everywhere uniformly. There's no distinction. The particle on a sphere, for instance, the ground state is just uniformly supported on the sphere. But here you see the ground state actually is bound to these common lines. And it's not just the ground state. Many exciter states, pretty much all the exciter states we see, depending on S, look like this. They're all tied to these common lines.
Yes. These common lines, they indicate two spins in one direction and the other two in the opposite.
Yes. So in spin language, they mean they're collinear states. So two are here and two are antiparallel. So all spins lie along one direction, two this way and two opposite directions.
So is this also some consequence of symmetry, perhaps? Does this say tell us about the geometry of that particular like tetrahedron? If you just like have spins and you look at the ground state, that these ones will be selected somehow?
I will tell you why they're selected, but perhaps it's not just symmetry. Perhaps if you want to use symmetry, you could use it in the opposite sense. So imagine a particle moving on a circle. Every point on the circle is as good as any other point. So the probability cannot be special anywhere. So if you have the XY dimer, for instance, all ground states are equal, so just get spread. But here, the ground states are not all related by symmetry. You take a collinear state, you take a coplanar state, there's no symmetry that connects them. That's why you're allowed to have this in principle, but that alone does not explain this. You need something more. Okay, good. So let me try to explain to you why this is true. So it's very easy to see in the tight binding model. So imagine these two tori and there's a common red line to them. Let's just focus there. So if you want to think of the space, it looks like this. There is one sheet corresponding to the one torus, one sheet corresponding to this torus, and they intersect each other along a line. They intersect like this. You can just write the tight binding model for this, and you can easily check that there are well-defined bound state wave functions that look like this. So you can analytically check this. So just to explain this to you, Q is equal to zero means you're on the red line. When Q is positive, you move up. Q is negative, you move down. So you see that if Q is not zero, there's an exponential factor that decays as mod Q. So away from this, you decay exponentially. And along this, it looks like there's just a momentum. So if Q is zero, there's some angle that depends on P, which is actually just this. So to cut it short, the tight binding model has bound state solutions that can be found analytically. And these are the low energy states of the tight binding model. And they correspond to a particle that's localized here, exponentially decays away from this. And it is free to have angular momentum along this. That's this L quantum number. So it's as if, imagine this is just a straight line. It can have momentum. It can move this way or move the other way. That is free to.
What's the scale of alpha?
So in this problem, it turns out alpha is just some constant.
It's
just some number. Doesn't even. And for all, you can choose any angular momentum. Alpha doesn't change. And we think it's some strong property. So any one co-dimension, one defect, alpha is always fixed.
But
in the case.
Going back to spin model,
yes,
and downfolding it back to this,
yes,
alpha doesn't depend on S?
Does not.
Must be.
So alpha, I think, will not depend on S, but there can be some further. Let's come back to this at the end. So I have one figure that might help to explain this. So in some sense, you can imagine that the mapping to the tight binding is perfect when S is infinity. Then you have corrections. So S is infinity, it really looks like this, but in practice, it looks like that for all S, for pretty much every S. Okay, so bound states that look like this, and this is some generic feature of dynamics on spaces like this that intersect, that you can have bound state solutions. The simplest thing is even some kind of just a figure of eight, two circles that are touching. If you just do a tight binding model for that, you see the ground state is a bound state. You get that. Okay, so what does this mean? It means you have the ground state space is actually three tori. However, in low energies, at low energies, the particle just gets stuck to one of three lines. There are two red lines, two green lines, two black lines. So in practice, the particle is stuck to this, this, or this. So the particle looks like this. It only cares about three rings. It forgets about the remaining part of the ground state space. Okay? So low energy states are all localized along singular lines in the ground state space. And the low energy physics is dominated by these bound states, which are actually collinear ground states. So the important thing here is, this effect persists even in the S tends to infinity limit. So we can say S is very large. In principle, this mapping is perfect when S is infinity. And this is holds. When S is infinity, there's a large classical ground state space, but only a subset is seen. Only the three collinear lines are seen. So there are some old results in a purely classical model from 1998, Chopper and Mosner. And they see that, so this, what we presented, you can think of this as a quantum version of this result. But it actually gives you more insight into why this happens. Okay, they show that in a classical XY quaternion, even at T tends to zero, some states are selected. But it's not clear why. Okay, so let me show you the proof for this. Right? So here is the spin problem for S19, a very, very large spin, which we can diagonalize after doing some tricks. So this is the spin spectrum. And we've just changed the energy, changed the units, shifted it. And you look at the spectrum. It's three. There's a ground state which is threefold degenerate, sixfold degenerate, sixfold degenerate, sixfold, sixfold, sixfold. The energies are 0, 1, 4, 9, 16, 25. This is the same as a particle that lives on three separate circles. So we just diagonalized the four spin problem for a very large S. The spectrum looks like a particle that lives on three circles, although the ground state space is actually the three tori forming a non-manifold. Okay, so. So some of you, if you're familiar with magnetism, you might be familiar with the concept of order by disorder. So we would like to make a distinction. So we think there are two different mechanisms. There's one we should call order by disorder, and one that we should call order by singularity. And let me just try to distinguish the two of them to you. Okay. So typically, whenever you have frustrated magnets, you have a large classical degeneracy. And some subset of these states can be selected. And there are two mechanisms to do that. And so let me just describe these two to you before. So the classic one known for a long time is order by disorder. That's, for instance, in the book Introduction to Frustrated Magnetism, there's an article by Chalker that explains this. Ironically, that article also has examples of this, but these two were not distinguished at that time. So we actually think there are two distinct mechanisms.
But if I remember correct,
yes.
The word order by disorder was introduced by Villain.
Villain, yes. So it goes a very long. Villain, yes, okay, that's true. So it has a much, this is just some pedagogical article on this. Good, so how can we think of order by disorder? So this is how we see it. So imagine we have a large classical ground state degeneracy, and then we have weak fluctuations. So for instance, weak quantum fluctuations. Now they can give rise to zero point energies, and this is an energy correction, and this can be different at different states. So this will therefore break the degeneracy. Okay, so you have many states, you have some small fluctuation corrections, and that will select one state. You say, this has a lower energy correction than that. So you pick that state. Or you could have weak thermal fluctuations, so low temperature and a classical spin that's fluctuating. And now these fluctuations will contribute entropies to the free energy. Now this can be different for different states. This can also break degeneracy. If you're stuck in one state where you can fluctuate more, you gain more entropy, you'll be stuck there rather than somewhere else. This is well established in many, many models, very long history of this. So how do we map this to a single particle picture, the picture that we have described? Okay. So the way I've described it, the spin problem maps to a single particle moving on the classical ground state space. Now these small fluctuations, either quantum or thermal, they give rise to a potential on this space. So there's some 1 over S correction that gives you some potential energy if you're at different points. And because of this potential, the particle is localized. And when you approach the classical limit, for instance, if S goes to infinity or you go to the zero temperature limit, so there are no thermal fluctuations, then this potential will go away. Because potential comes from small fluctuations. You go to this limit, then there are no fluctuations, so this potential goes away, there is no selection. So the usual order by disorder mechanism, when you go to S infinity or T zero, this mechanism will vanish. It will not operate. In contrast, order by singularity will be the strongest in that limit. So let me describe this to you. So here there is a necessary condition, is that the ground state space should have non-manifold character. It should be self-intersecting with some lines. And this should lead to bound state formation. So when you map it to a single particle motion, these singularities look like impurities, they create bound states. The low energy spectrum is spanned only by bound states, and this localizes the particle. Particle gets stuck in bound states and doesn't move. So in the classical limit, if you map a single particle picture, this single particle moving at the space picture becomes improves as you increase S. So you go to T tends to zero or S tends to infinity, this mapping is better and better. It becomes perfect. So the selection effect becomes very strong. So this is very different from this. So just to show that to you in some picture. So imagine that this is some classical ground state space. The usual order by disorder, or what we think of as what we think should be called order by disorder, looks like this picture. You have some ground state space, a particle is moving on this space, but you have small fluctuations set by 1 over S or temperature, small temperature. That gives rise to some kind of a potential on this space. Now if you're at low temperature, you'll get stuck to the minima of this potential. It can be here or there, but you will not explore the space. This is the usual order by disorder, or this is what we think should be called order by disorder. In contrast, you can have ground state spaces that look like this, and there's some the space self-intersect at a point. So this is just a cartoon picture. You can imagine something like this. In this case, you can actually form bound states that are here. So at low energies, the particle will just get stuck in the bound state. It will not move anywhere else. So this is another mechanism for state selection. You select a subset of classical ground states. So non-manifold ground state, which allows for bound state formation. So this is a qualitative difference here. So you were asking, does alpha change with S, for instance, right? So if you have some finite S, so suppose you have this kind of a state and finite S. So imagine you have this state and then a potential superimposed on top of it. So it can change alpha, presumably, by some amount. But it's hard to measure in the actual spin problem. But presumably it can affect it.
But the fact that you have something like an 8 is a topological property.
Exactly.
Independent of S.
Yes. So even in S tends to infinity, it works.
Right? In the order by disorder mechanism, in the classical case, right?
Yes.
In both cases, in the
let's say classical zero temperature.
Let's take the order of limits in separate orders.
Okay.
So in the classical case,
yes,
there's an experimental principle. It's the free energy. So at finite temperature, you want to fluctuate on states which have larger fluctuation spectrum to increase the entropy.
Yes.
At zero temperature, then there's no longer selection.
Yes.
And then when you have for a quantum problem, then you have the zero point energy that acts as the selection. Principle.
Yes.
So what's the extremizing principle here for this scenario? It doesn't seem that there is one.
So if you can think of it as mapping it to a particle, and then the particle dynamics is it is dominated by bound states. So this the spin path integral maps to a path integral for particle moving on the space, and that is dominated by bound states at low temperature. So that's the mechanism.
I'm a bit confused, admittedly, because I know there's two pieces of work on the power claw XY system,
yes,
which is a bit different because it's local XY,
yes,
which is work done by myself and Paul McCarthy,
yes,
and work done by
Jeff Frau.
Not in that paper, but there's also some work by Nick Shannon and collaborators.
Okay.
And I think in that case, what they identify as the and some special trajectory in phase space, which leads to what we call order by disorder, is exactly that the two manifolds intercept on these lines, and there's more fluctuation by condensing the system around these points, which are these special intersection of manifolds, of not manifolds, but trajectories. But we still called it order by disorder because either in calculating the entropy or the zero point energy, there was a decrease of energy or an increase of entropy. So I'm a bit confused how this last scenario can be extracted on its own.
Yes. So that's a hard So you write that it's possible that both of them will select the same state. So if you just calculate the free energy due to fluctuations, that might also be minimum there. Generically, you expect it to be minimum at a high symmetry point. However, the mechanism is, you know, it's fundamentally different. This does not rely on minimizing energy in some sense. So one possible way might be if you could controllably change S, suppose there's some family of materials or even theoretically, you should see that selection effect become stronger and stronger because of this. Whereas if it were just that, selection effect would become weaker and weaker with this. That's just one way to distinguish the two effects. It's not clear to me, it's how, so this is still, on a cluster, it's very clear to see. Just four spins is easy to see. More than that, this, you have to do some more work.
But one experience,
sure.
These days you can make quantum wires.
Yes.
Two-way junction and variable junction. Mm. So the bound state that we are talking about should be there at least.
Yes.
Characteristic.
Yes, it's actually very easy. Just any figure of eight should. So, so people have thought about this for a long time. People like A.P. Balachandran, know, just to define, you know, how to define the boundary conditions in quantum mechanics correctly to get bound states. People have thought about that. But the new thing here is, so what we are saying is, there are bound states, but the bound states are actually the lowest energy states, and therefore they're the most physically accessible states. That part was not there, not at least clearly before. And experimentally, presumably, it could be done in many ways. Okay, so last slide, I'll just summarize what I've said. So I've tried to build on a principle. So at low energies, the physics of any cluster of quantum spins maps to a single particle problem. The single particle moves on the corresponding classical ground state space. So that's the principle I've tried to build on. So building on that, I've shown you some examples. The three prominent ones, or two prominent ones, is this. So for instance, for the XY trimer is just a triangle, three spins. I showed that you can have a particle moving in the space, but that space actually has an Arnau-Bohm flux. It has these flux tubes threaded through it. So you have to take that into account. So you can get two disjoint circles threaded with pi fluxes. And you can perhaps with some other cluster geometries, we could even tailor more interesting such physics. So physics of particles moving on these kind of objects are interesting, have been studied, for instance, kicked rotors and things like that. Presumably, you can simulate them using spin clusters. The second important point I've described to you is the quadrumer, the four-spin tetrahedron. Here, the ground state space I've described to you is a non-manifold. There's three tori that touch lines. And here, I've tried to convince you that you can use a tight binding model to describe the low energy spectrum as a particle moving on the space. And the next point I've said is, when there is a particle moving on the space, the low energy spectrum consists solely of bound states. Actually, many, many low energy states are all bound states. So in the spin problem, this leads to a preference for collinear states over other states, but the preference persists even in the classical limit. So it's not a weak phenomenon, it's a very strong phenomenon. So thank you very much. Thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Yeah. Is it possible to take your tetramer and change the quantization direction to make it like more realistic and
yes.
To fulfill this, the tetragonal group symmetry such that it corresponds to real systems?
We've not tried it yet, yes.
But you think it's possible to go in that direction?
Yeah, very much, yes. You mean like local XY, yes, should be very much possible, yes.
What about Heisenberg antiferromagnet? Does it become more complicated or easier?
So that was the previous talk I gave with, okay. So it has many common features. The ground state space there is also non-manifold. But it's a much bigger space. It's a five-dimensional space with singular subspaces. So there it turns out that no bound states are formed. Although there are singularities present, bound states are not formed. We think the reason is as follows. So here, you see the space is two-dimensional. The singularities are lines. So it's the singular lines are co-dimension one defects. They're one dimension less than the space. The Heisenberg problem, they're co-dimension three. So there is some other general work saying that for co-dimension greater than two, you generically don't form bound states. And we see that the physics, actually, there are no bound states. We can ignore the singularities, the Heisenberg model, And that gives a very good description, explains this. So in some sense, this space is a slice of that space. That's a higher dimensional space. By making it an XY model, that's how we originally started thinking about this. You actually take out a smaller subset. Then the physics completely changes.
And people have discussed spin clusters, like MN12 and so on.
Yes.
Like spin quantum tunneling. MN12, FE8. Hmm. Are there experimental systems where the theory could be closer to?
So far, we don't know. We found some, but they all have too many complications. They have phonons, they have DM interactions, they have some strong some Ising-like anisotropies. So far, we have not found a nice system. But if there are some, we should look for some. Perhaps.
Can't you have... I guess if you had a checkerboard lattice,
yes,
with... You need to have pi junctions, right, to generate anti-ferromagnetism, because otherwise you'd have ferromagnetic couplings,
yes, okay,
in the superconducting grains, right?
Yes.
So you need maybe cold atoms.
Maybe cold atoms, yes. Yeah. That's true.
Like frustrated Josephson lattice.
Yeah, you need to have the sign of J that is like Josephson junction would have
the pi junction.
Yeah, pi junctions, yeah.
There might even be some other clusters, not necessarily the... So we have some new work, it's not out yet, for instance, some Kitaev-like clusters. It's still artificial, but we think it's actually a very generic phenomenon. There might be many systems where the space looks like this. So this physics can occur in many other systems. So far we know of this example. We know of some other examples which have some Kitaev-like clusters, which I can tell you about. And there must be more.
Yeah.
And if there are materials, that would be fantastic. I'll ask you if there are some.
I'm still interested about this. If you took two tetrahedra,
yes,
touching at one corner, so
yes,
one shared spin,
yes,
would it map into two particles moving on the space with some interaction between them?
Okay. Yes, I would guess it will map to. Yeah, I can work it out. My guess is it will map to two separate particles. One particle moving on one copy of this space. One particle moving on another copy of this space.
But not on the same space.
Not on the same space.
You think of that as being moving in the same space with some sort of interaction.
So if you
take mapping into free particle,
right?
Single,
yes,
free particle low energy.
Yes.
But
yes. So if you just tie one spin, it might not be enough. But maybe if they share an edge, perhaps it's possible that you'll get some combined bigger space. But yeah, I don't know. You have to check. That's true.
But if you have class Beaver clusters, would you expect that at least in the XY model, that selection of those particular collinear states keeps happening near the
bigger clusters? As in what sense?
If you have one tetrahedra and then another tetrahedra just joined to that tetrahedra, like Beaver clusters,
yes,
two or three or more tetrahedra, would you expect that particular state of collinear spins to be selected again?
By this mechanism. Collinear states might be selected even by the other mechanism, but it's not clear to me yet. So part of the problem is when you make the clusters bigger, the space becomes too big to draw. So at some point we got stuck with that. But in principle, it's possible. You have to find out. We don't know yet. It might still work. Yes.
Let's thank Ganesh then. Thank you.